be assessed against it. Those are the provisions.
The bar explanation.
I'm wondering.
And the excuse me.
Oregon State bar explanation of the process for the people.
Representative Burton?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if Representative Bunn, if in dealing with clients of yours, you would recommend that they go into a business deal with someone else without asking for some kind of a ability to have a buyer's remorse clause, which you do when you make any other kind of business deal with anyone else, without specifying more specifically what kind of arrangement you're making it. Essentially, I understand. I don't think that society necessarily thinks of lawyers. Maybe I thought lawyers only thought of as bad folks inside the legislature, but I disagree that there is anything more than a business arrangement being made here.
Well,
and why not allow a person to make a legitimate business? I know that lawyers don't like themselves as business people, but they do pay taxes, business taxes.
Mr. Chairman, the question was asked, shouldn't we let people remove themselves from this agreement just as they do in any other business transaction? I would suggest that in the vast majority of business transactions, we don't allow a person to remove themselves. It's only in those that legislative bodies have clearly identified as having problems that we allow the removal, and this is not one of those that we've identified as having problems. And I have a problem in the relationship of private contract in saying that we'll regulate that private contract in this way without a public policy hearing. And to me, an obvious extension is that we should begin regulating the contingent arrangements in financial planning in a whole series of private industry that this doesn't even touch. And I think the only reason, frankly, that attorneys have been touched is because of the particular perception of attorneys in our society. So I again say that there's no evidence that there's the need for a backup clause. There's no testimony that there are abuses. And I think we simply need to make policy based on the real need.
Okay, is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll on Representative Bunn's motion to substitute the language from 323 section 12 for section 8 of the -116 amendments relating to attorney's fees and agreements.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Question of Representative Phillips. What does the last sentence in your amendment mean?
Excuse me. My last sentence in my amendment? The any other fee shall?
Yeah.
If I went to you, Representative Hanlon, and were asking for guidance on an offer that I had received in writing, and I said, what do you think of that? And you said to me, I think you ought to accept that, but it's somewhat complicated. I need to draw it up in a contractual arrangement. We need to do some things, and that requires a performance of service. I don't know what your hourly rates are, whether they're $60 or $250, but whatever your work you put into it would be reflected in your fee.
Okay. Further discussion? Okay, if not, the clerk will call the roll on Representative Bunn's motion.
Dahlman?
Aye.
Dahlman?
No.
Bunn?
Aye.
Burton?
No.
Dix?
No.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Miller?
No.
Phillips?
No.
Springer?
Aye. Motion fails.
Mr. Chair?
Who is a vote, Mr. Chair?
4 aye votes.
5 no votes. No votes representing Burton, Dix, Bellamy. Phillips, Miller.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Phillips.
I would acknowledge that the language used in draft 119, specifying the meaning of subsection 3 on page 7, is better than what is now adopted. So I would like to move the substitution of that language. Again, that's in the draft 119, subsection 3, drafted by apparently Representative Bunn, into the position of draft 116.
Okay, Representative Phillips moves that the 119 Section 8 sub-3 language be substituted for that in the Dash 116 amendments. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Representative Phillips, I am still confused over the final sentence. Is that referring to a contingent fee or a per hour fee?
What we're trying to express there is that you would not get a contingent fee if you didn't do anything, but you'd be able to charge the person for the services that you were doing, which I would say would be an hourly fee or a fee for service.
I just think the final sentence is confusing. That's my only comment. With any other fee, shall reflect the extent of services performed. Doesn't speak. First of all, you can't tell whether it refers to a contingent or an hourly rate. And I would imagine whether one is a contingent or hourly, that it's the law that it shall reflect the extent of services performed.
Okay. Is there further discussion?
One question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
Senator Phillips, was there any testimony or evidence in front of the subcommittee of any relationship at all between contingent fees and insurance rates or insurance availability?
Yeah, absolutely. You might want to narrow that question down if you're trying to get it to subsection 3. Because the attorney's fees and the cost both for plaintiff's attorneys and defense attorneys were alleged to be a significant factor.
Is the follow-up question?
Representative Bauman.
Does the insurance company pay anything additional to a prevailing plaintiff because of the existence or non-existence of the attorney's contingent fee or based upon the terms of the contingent fee?
Could you speak up, please, and I'll sit up so I can hear you.
I'll sit up and speak up. Does the insurance company end up paying anything different, or is the award any different given by the jury based upon the existence or non-existence or any of the terms of a contingent fee?
But normally, I would suspect the jury does not know what the contingency fee agreement is between attorney and client.
And the contingent fee is not paid over and above what is awarded to a plaintiff by a jury, is it?
Usually, or at least the evidence presented, suggested that the attorney's fees came out of what now would be defined as non-economic damages to the person, if indeed an award was given. At least that was my impression of the testimony received.
Further questions? Okay, if not, we're on the motion to substitute the subparagraph 3 from 119 for that in 116. Any objection to that? Substitution only.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
I'll vote aye.
Any objections?
I'd like to be recorded as an aye.
Okay, we'll all be recorded as an aye unless there's an objection. Okay. Anything else? Contingent fees.
Okay.
If not, next section.
Moving on, collateral source. Begins on page 7 of all three drafts, and the meat of the issue is on page 8. What we tried to get at generally, or philosophically, if you will, is that after the final judgment is in, and you know where you won or lost and what the amount would be, the collateral source benefits would be provided to the judge, who could then make a determination of deductibility from the award. We, in Section 3, you will see, defined what we thought collateral source should be. The major discussion, or one of the issues raised, was whether we should say Social Security retirement benefits, down on line 18. Since you had this section, Representative Dix, do you remember any other major issues to it?
No. There was some discussion that I noticed Representative Bunn addresses that in his, where it was our intentions that the judge may look at those things. I notice Representative Bunn here shall.
The other issue that was up is with our May language, there was no standards for the judge to apply as to whether he should deduct them or shouldn't deduct them, and that was an issue that was raised, I think, by the chairman. But at any rate, it was raised.
Representative Dix, did you have anything to add?
No, just that the compromise that was worked out was May, and I think this is an important ingredient in the overall package.
May
is on line 3 of page 8. In blue, and on 119, okay. It's on same line 4.
That's true. Okay, I think what's in Hanlon and then what's in Bunn.
I asked a question in sub, and I'll ask it again of the proponents. Where does Medicare and Medicaid, that is the payments for poor people and elderly that reflect health care, that are not listed in the examples in sub 3, where do those go?
Well, the answer is the same, and Representative Dix is willing and add into it. Means health insurance benefits was one answer, and the catch-all phrase would be other disability benefits. So indeed, they could be listed as a collateral source.
Well, I'm speaking of health payments made on behalf of poor people at the state, those people not having insurance, when I speak of Medicaid. So what you're telling me is that's health insurance?
Yeah, that's what we answered in subcommittee. That would fall under health insurance. That those payments go to defray the cost of the health care, isn't that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, they would fall. It would be our intention that they would fall under health insurance benefits.
I'm just informed that Medicare is specifically reimbursable by federal law, so there would be no reimbursement, I would assume, there. Therefore.
Representative
Bunn? Mr. Chairman, I would move on line 4 of page 8 and wherever else it would need to be done to conform, to replace the word may with shall.
Line 3.
Is that correct?
If we're working off the dash 116 amendments, appears to be the proper place. Representative Bunn has moved that line 3, page 8, 116 amendments, that the word may be replaced with the word shall, and that also be substituted, if necessary, at other locations in that section to achieve the same intent. Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chairman, to briefly set the stage for the reason for that, I want to give a parallel area. In medical insurance, if a person has two medical insurance policies, they will often provide that only one of the policies will pay for the medical treatment and the other won't pay a second. If you had two policies and they both said they'd pay 100%, you'd have a 200% recovery. You'd walk away with your medical treatment another 100%. The collateral source issue is basically the same issue in another arena. And the basic concept says that if you are being paid from some other source that you didn't have to pay for, we're not going to have the court awarded judgment pay you a second time. So if you get a $100,000 judgment in court for medical costs, and you already got $50,000 of costs from another source that you didn't have to pay for, we'll reduce the judgment by $50,000 so that you don't get a surplus. That is designed to keep the cost of insurance down by not having duplicate payment costs. If we use the word may, it destroys the section. It will not provide a meaningful collateral source. There's no standard, and it is not, without the word shall, a meaningful section. If, as a policy matter, we do not want to offset collateral source payments, we ought to just take it out of the bill. If, in fact, we want to offset collateral sources, that being getting payment twice that you didn't have to pay for, the only way you can do that effectively is have the word shall. So it's simply a policy issue of whether we want an effective collateral source section or not. If we have may in there, we ought to take it out of the bill. If we have shall, it works.
Tim Dix.
Well, there was a great deal of discussion on the subject in subcommittee, and it dealt with the issue of those who take the time out of their lives and pre-plan with regard to providing for their families and make payments on different types of policies, and then if an accident should occur and a liability situation arise, find out that the only thing they're going to get back is the court's going to award them the amount of money they paid for premiums in that policy, and what they get from that policy, which is they paid on their whole lives, will be the premium that they paid into it, and the amount they get from the policy will be deducted from the total settlement. There wasn't any conclusion drawn in committee. What this section does is say that the judge may take a look at that and address the settlement or verdict if there is an unfair situation that arises where someone is receiving a settlement or a verdict as well as a sum of money that is extraordinary given other benefits. And it's a true compromise in the area of collateral source. I don't think that the 323C bill addresses it at all. And May was the compromise we came up with, that it gives the bench the authority to look at this question.
Okay, Phillips.
Well, Representative Dix is correct, and the original 323C doesn't address it. It fascinates me that at times we argue that judges follow the law, and then we argue the judges don't follow the law. We are giving the judge discretion in this case that he may, and to even cinch it up a little bit tighter, we delineated what a collateral source is so that they could make that judgment, because clearly I don't want people that are getting, as Representative Bunn says, paid twice inappropriately to walk off with some windfall. We described the other disability benefits and I'll be up front with you, it's an open-ended catch-all phrase so that the judge can evaluate the variety of other sources that the individual might have. I guess it's a matter of just decision as to whether you think that the judge is going to follow the intent of the law or not.
Representative Phillips, then is it the intent of the law that collateral sources where they would be double payment would be deducted? Is that the direction we're giving the court? I'd like to have Representative Phillips answer.
If you follow that, if they fall within what a collateral source is and they should be deducted, the judge can make that decision to deduct them. Yes.
Well, let me ask you, as I understood Representative Phillips, your indication was that we didn't want double payments and tried to tighten this up to give the judge a clear direction. Is our clear direction to the judge that where there is that double payment, we want a deduction for a collateral source?
Given the definitions of sub 3, however, the shall that you suggested in all cases must happen, I think in the cases that it will have, the judgment of the bench will rise above and make the right choice, and they need the ability to make that choice and discretion. So in the cases of common sense where they shouldn't be double paid, they won't be.
What's next? Dix, anything else?
Just there are different cases different situations arise. Somebody may have a $2,500 disability policy, somebody may have a $250,000 disability policy. In one instance, I don't think it's worth the bench's time to take a look at it, and the other, perhaps that might be the case. It's up to the judge to, and it gives the judge that discretion.
Further discussion on Representative Bunn's motion to substitute shall from 8, line 3, page 8 of the Room 16 amendments. If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellman?
No.
Bellamy?
No.
Bunn?
Aye.
Burton?
No.
Dix?
No.
Hammond?
No.
Miller?
No.
Phillips?
No.
Stringer?
No.
Question of the proponents. Is it your intent, now I'm referring to workers' compensation statute 656.593, that allows that the proceeds of any damages recovered from either from a third party shall be the subject of a lien for the insurance company for its share of the proceeds set forth and shall be distributed as follows: costs and attorney's fees, the worker shall receive at least one third of such recovery, paying agency shall recover the balance but only to the extent it's compensated for what it actually paid. Is it your intent then to, under the circumstances where that occurs, not have the judge deduct prior to the distribution?
I don't want to mess around with workers' comp statutes. That's why they're down as a collateral source. If the judge evaluates the person is getting a temporary time loss or some other benefit for whatever reason, that is a collateral source, if that answers your question. That is my intent.
But, no, your statute refers to prior to the entry of final judgment.
Correct.
This statute gives the insurance company certain rights under a formula as lien after final judgment.
That's correct. I don't want to change their ability. Now, I'm not arguing the philosophy whether that's right or wrong. However, in this case, since that's the standard practice within the workers' comp laws of this state today, and you and I might disagree as to whether that's right or not, I am not changing that standard.
Okay.
And if there was an award given, and they would therefore place a lien or follow any other action statutorily approved, then they would still have that right. I would suspect that there's probably a divergence in your and my view on that, or perhaps not.
Let me ask it again, or at least try and reformulate it. Where there's a third party is insured, there's an insurance company paying. Your statute goes to how much they pay. This statute goes to how much the workers' compensation insurance company would get back to what they've already paid. In addition, if the insurance company gets to deduct prior to the entry of final judgment, it would not be your intent that the judge duplicate by allowing that deduction while at the same time having to take into consideration the statute that guarantees the workers' compensation insurance company money, would it?
If I interpret your question to say, if the judge decides that is a collateral source and pays, deducts that money so it's not a pay twice situation, and therefore I'm assuming the third party would get it funny. Is that what you're telling me?
It would appear if the judge deducts under your statute a workers' comp as a collateral source, that both the workers' comp insurance company and the claimant would receive less, and that the workers' comp insurance company and claimant would be already subject to a statute that allows for these deducts.
And I am not suggesting we change that.
You're not suggesting that we double that the judge in those circumstances deduct.
That's why the judge would have.
That's why the judge would have the discretion to take into consideration such existing laws after final entry of judgment.
That's why Representative Bunn and I disagree on this point.
I just want to get that in the record. You're leaving a lot of discretion to deal with other existing statutes that may be in effect, including this one that I've found, there may be others, that apply to the distribution of the proceeds after the entry of judgment. This statute applies to the amount of the final judgment.
Okay. Further clarification? Anything else on the collateral source section? Okay. Representative Phillips.
Okay. The next section is the titled criminal conduct under the Dix Phillips or Phillips Dix plan, which is 116. And I noticed on dash 119, it's entitled injury or death while committing a felony. And I don't even want to attempt to discuss Representative Bunn's motion since he's not here to talk about it. What we discussed, the major issues in subcommittee, and there was quite a bit of dissension on this, by the way. Representative Dix and I take a rather hardline approach to individuals committing crimes, and therefore their legal or their potential ability through litigation and how it's affected by that activity. It was brought up that there are many Class C felonies that perhaps we shouldn't take such a hardline stance on. We were not convinced, I would have to say. That, unless I'm misreading it from the other members of the committee that are here, that was the major policy issue discussed at this point. The change, so that you know, is that we added Class C felonies, and the majority reporters that came across dealt with Class A and Class B felonies.
I think Representative Bunn will want to address this issue.
Can I ask a question about
the tapes out?
Have you done?
Yeah, you've heard it all before.
That's what I'm hearing.
Well, I just want to ask the question, does this contemplate that the person should have been convicted of the crime before this is a bar?
We debated that at some length in subcommittee. And according to my interpretation of if you list A and B and C felonies, and if it was to run its course, it would presumably be convicted of having done that crime. So that they can make a judgment as to whether or not it would affect his right towards litigation.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
That being the intention, may I suggest a friendly amendment that we insert that resulted in conviction of, instead of would constitute, on line 25.
Well, would you consider, I guess, if that was what you wanted to do, if a person was damaged, was engaged in conduct that resulted in the conviction at the time of the, I'm not sure what the best place to put it in, Representative Bauman, but I'm just saying I'm not opposed to that clarification, although Representative Dix has some feelings on this, so I appreciate it. But the question is clarification of whether that the conduct at the time, were they convicted of that activity, and clarifying it in the statute. I think that appropriately reflects the discussion.
I don't think we came to a conclusion on it. It's a section that
I
pose more questions than we had the answers for. The example was given of the college students who go out on a prank, and we had an extreme example where someone shoots a burglar, and that's okay. And then the second example was, well, what happens if a group of college students get together and they go out and steal a pig, and or they go out in an attempt to steal a pig, and there's a fence put up that electrocutes you, and in stealing the pig, one of the students gets electrocuted. What do you do in that situation? And that raised the question in my mind. And Representative Phillips, I think, I may not be properly reflecting his remarks, but he indicated that no students would be breaking the law, and they shouldn't have any...